We'd like to open a casino near the county line. Maybe two.
And all I have to do is leave you alone? I said. She nodded.
You tell the sheriff you won't prosecute us. We'll stay in the county so the Knoxville City Police won't bother us. If the TBI tries to sting us, you make sure it goes away.
What do I do about the others? The cockfighters and the dogfighters and the bare-knuckle fighters and the pimps? What do I do about this Roby Penn you were talking about?
As far as Penn goes, we're going to have to figure out a way to take him out of the picture, and it isn't going to be easy, especially since he's the sheriff's uncle. The rest of them? I don't care what you do about them except for my friend. I'll tell you her name when the time comes. Chances are you won't have to worry about it, though, because they've already made their deals with the sheriff. They've been around forever, so I don't really see anything changing.
The sheriff isn't suddenly going to start bringing you dogfighting and cockfighting cases to prosecute.
Your office won't be deluged with gambling and prostitution cases. The biggest obstacle is that you and the sheriff are going to have to figure out a way to get along. You're going to have to trust each other.
Which means I'll have to go on the take with that carnival barker. He's a showboating redneck. I can't stand him. The sheriff of Knox County was the kind of stereotype that I loathed. The big, fat, loud southern county sheriff. Many local sheriffs in Tennessee operated quietly. They were powerful in their own fiefdoms and served 8-year terms, so their primary focus was usually to get elected and then get under the radar and stay there. Once a sheriff got himself elected in Tennessee, the voters rarely heard from him until he came up for re-election, and if he hadn't done anything stupid, they'd re-elect him. It was fairly easy to stay out of sight, too, because the truth of the matter was that nobody really cared about the criminal justice system. It was one of the bastard stepchildren of government. Politicians and taxpayers didn't want to fund it. Nobody wanted to think about it unless they had to, and nobody outside the system really cared about the elections of criminal court judges or sheriffs or district attorneys or public defenders. Sure, there was the prurient interest generated by murders and rape and violence and corruption, but the fact of the matter was that our society, like most societies, didn't give a tinker's damn about people who committed crimes. We wanted people who murdered, people who raped and robbed and assaulted other people who used or sold drugs, and people who ran whores or gambling operations removed from society, warehoused, and forgotten. They were nothing more than short-term fodder for the news industry and a source of employment for those prosecutors and cops and defense lawyers and judges and clerks and probation officers and all the others employed by the criminal justice system who fooled themselves into believing there was such a thing as justice and wanted to be a part of that system. Once we were all done using the criminals for our own benefit, they became a dirty, forgotten little secret, and nobody really cared. But the sheriff of Knox County, a larger-than-life cowboy hat-wearing, chain-smoking blowhard by the name of Clifford Tree Corker, preferred the spotlight. He didn't toil in silence or in private. There appeared to be nothing cerebral about him. The 42-year-old had been sheriff for 8 years, having been appointed by the county commission for 2 years after the previous sheriff fell off a roof and broke his neck, and then having won another 6-year term at the polls. He was up for re-election in November, but nobody was opposing him. Corker made sure he strutted onto the stage of every crime scene in the county that attracted a television camera or a news reporter. He held press conferences on a regular basis, touting his department's latest drug roundup or the apprehension of the latest danger to the good people of Knox County in a deep southern base. He vowed to enforce the law of the land and carried 2 pearl-handled, nickel-plated, ornately engraved .45-caliber Colt Python double-action revolvers in holsters he tied around his massive thighs with strips of rawhide. If the law of the land was broken and he needed to blow somebody full of holes, he was ready.
"Don't sell Tree Corker short," Granny said. "He's powerful, and he appears dangerous. He's got a boatload of laws that say he can do pretty much anything he wants. The FBI ignores him, and he has 1,000 employees. Most of those employees are loyal to him just because he gave them a job. 500 of them are armed and trained to use their weapons. He has a jail he'd love to put you in if you cross him.
I was in it for a year, I said. It was a shithole, and I'm never going back.
You'll have to figure out a way to deal with him, Granny said. Telling him you're willing to turn the other cheek and go on about your business would be my suggestion. But there are some folks who are going to have to leave his county, his uncle in particular, in order for us to come in, so that'll have to be worked out. We don't care if we pay him the same cut his uncle has been giving him, but we're not paying any more.
How do you propose to get this Roby Penn out of the county? I said.
By upsetting his apple cart, Granny said. By making him extremely uncomfortable. He'll make a mistake when we do that, and we'll be waiting.
Will I be involved in upsetting his apple cart? I said.
We're going to run you into it like a Brahma bull, Granny said.
How are you going to do this, Granny? How are you going to get me elected? You have to tell me.
Soon. I'll tell you soon.
I looked at Eugene and Ronnie, then back at Granny. I nodded my head. Fine. I'm in. You folks have put your lives and your freedom on the line for me more than once. You help me get elected district attorney, and I'll make sure you get to do whatever you want.
We won't kill anybody unless it's absolutely necessary, Granny said.
I suppose I appreciate that. So what's first?
I'm going to make a phone call or two and get you some real help, Granny said. I'm talking real money and real advice and assistance. Bankers and legitimate business people by senators and representatives, not district attorneys and sheriffs. People like me usually put up the money for people like you. But I've got something else in mind.
I can't say this surprises me, I said. The corruption, I mean. I saw it in prison. The guards were in on almost all the hustles. I guess I hadn't really thought about it here, though. I mean, Knox County specifically. And if it's here, it's everywhere.
All over the world, Darren?
That's depressing when you really think about it, I said. What about the district attorney in this county? Do you pay him?
He was here last evening, sitting right where you're sitting now, Granny said. Fine man. Think the world of him. And I pay him every month. Like clockwork.
Chapter 12. Tree Corker looked down through an opaque window at the large crowd of men in the abandoned warehouse off High School Road in the western part of Knox County. He was looking forward to watching two men do battle. He'd heard they were both good fighters with similar styles, and that the odds were nearly even. It was a bright, sunny Sunday afternoon outside, but inside the dark aura of bloodlust hung heavy in the dim light. Corker caught intermittent whiffs of dog and chicken dung, blood, man's sweat, and fear. He knew the warehouse had stored many things over the 30 years of its existence. Tobacco, car parts, water heaters, weapons, explosives, marijuana, and cocaine. He also knew it was now owned by a corporation formed by the heirs of the late Jess Plummer and leased through the heir's lawyer on a month-to-month handshake agreement to his uncle, a white supremacist bookmaker, hustler, and maybe even a psychopath, named Roby Penn. Roby was standing 10 feet across the room. He was a thin 65-year-old former LRRP, long-range reconnaissance patrol in the Vietnam War. Roby was wearing short-sleeve khaki military fatigues. His arms were covered in tattoos, his head was shaved, and he sported a thick white handlebar mustache. A gray scar crossed his nose like a small lightning bolt, the result of an argument with an ex-girlfriend with a bad temper and a beer bottle several years earlier. At least that's the story Tree had heard. He'd also heard the girlfriend had wound up in a dumpster.
Should be a good fight, Corker said. Who you betting on?
The Marine, Penn growled. Roby Penn often didn't speak like other men. He chose to communicate more like a wild animal, in snorts and growls.
Word is he's tough, but doesn't have much experience, Corker said.
He did 3 tours in Afghanistan, got shot 4 times, took a bunch of shrapnel from an IED, and is still standing. I know Shaker's a good fighter, but I'll take the Marine any time. He's like Sergeant Barnes from that movie Platoon. He ain't meant to die.
Corker knew the Marine was Gary Brewer.
He came from a wealthy family in Knoxville. His father and grandfather had both made fortunes in the insurance business.
"Didn't the Brewer kid go to college?"
Corker said. "Graduated from Tennessee with a business degree and then enlisted in the Marines," Penn said. "Headed straight for Afghanistan."
"Why in the hell would he do something like that?"
"Some people just feel the need to serve," Penn said. There was an edge to his voice. "I felt that need many years ago. I wish I hadn't done it now for a lot of reasons. Cost me half my left bicep. Then I came home to people calling me a baby killer. Come to find out the whole reason we went to Vietnam was a ruse by the government. But fuck it. Don't matter now."
Roby cast a sideways glance at Corker.
"I guess you never got the patriotic itch, did you? Never felt the need to serve your country?"
"Never did," Corker said. "And I ain't the least bit ashamed. I never thought it would be a good idea to go to some foreign land and risk getting my ass shot off for a bunch of crooks in Washington."
Corker exhaled a cloud of smoke from the cigarette he was puffing on.
"I don't see the politicians' sons going," he said. "And damned few of our representatives served in the military before they were elected. I always figured it'd be best for me to just stay right here and serve the people of my county."
"That seems to be working out pretty good for you," Penn said.
"It has since you and Clancy got me in this job," Corker said. "Who's Brewer fighting?"
"I told you earlier. Harley Shaker."
"Right. The bricklayer from Newport."
"Yeah.
I've seen Shaker fight. I ain't ever seen him lose."
"Should be interesting," Penn said.
"The gate looks pretty good today."
"Be more than $30,000. Once we figure up the vig on the bets, we should have a real good day."
Corker heard footsteps coming up the back stairs and turned to see Stephen Morris, the district attorney, walk into the room. Morris was wearing blue jeans and a black t-shirt.
"And there stands the last man I expected to see here today," Corker said. "What brings you out to our little playground?"
"Have you heard about Darren Street?" Morris said.
"The lawyer? The guy everybody thinks has killed a few folks and gotten away with it?"
"That's him," Morris said. "I think he just killed another one, but that's not the big problem."
"What is the big problem?"
"Can we have the room?" Morris said to Roby Penn.
"Fuck you. This is my place. You want privacy? Go outside."
"How about I just have the sheriff here arrest you and send your sorry ass off to prison for running an illegal gambling operation?" Morris said. Corker quickly stepped between the two men. He knew Roby and Morris had met, but they'd had very little contact. Morris didn't know how truly unpredictable Roby Penn could be. He didn't know that something as simple as the empty threat he just made could send Roby off the deep end.
"I got no intentions of arresting anyone," Corker said. He smiled widely. "Especially my Uncle Roby. He's paid you 10 times more money than the government has over the past 4 years. You'd be biting the hand that feeds you."
"He ought to learn some manners," Morris said.
"And maybe you ought to take your happy ass right back down those steps while you're still able," Penn said.
"Did you just threaten me? Did you just threaten the District Attorney General of Knox County?" Practically before the sheriff could blink, a nickel-plated Colt 1911 45 caliber semi-automatic pistol appeared from nowhere and was in his uncle's right hand. It was pointed at Morris's forehead.
"I'm not sure," Penn said. "Let's ask the sheriff. Did I just threaten the District Attorney General of Knox County?"
"Easy, Roby," Corker said. "Go easy now. Me and the District Attorney are going to walk down the stairs and have a little talk. When I come back, he won't be with me."
Penn nodded his head slowly, not taking his eyes off Morris.
"That sounds like a good idea," he said.
"We're going now,"
Corker said as he slowly took Morris by the arm and turned away.
"Why don't you just go ahead and put that hand cannon away?"
Corker followed Morris down the steps and out a small door that led to a loading dock at the back of the warehouse. A rusted chain-link fence separated the property from a line of white oak trees 100 feet away. Once they'd gotten outside, Mortis spun. His face was pink with rage.
"What the hell was that?" he yelled. "I mean, I know Roby's crazy, but he just aimed a pistol at my forehead. You ought to arrest him."
"Calm down," Corker said. "That man is my uncle and a big part of your paycheck every month, and you know it. He is not getting arrested, unless you want to go back up there and try it yourself. But if you do that, you and I both know you won't come back. Besides, what would be your explanation for being out here at this warehouse in the middle of nowhere while cockfighting, dogfighting, and bare-knuckle fighting is going on? Not to mention a shitload of illegal gambling. You're working undercover? You're looking for evidence in a case? Roby isn't one to be trifled with. He takes things to heart, and doesn't cotton to people coming onto his property and telling him what to do. I politely asked him to give us some privacy. Forget about it, all right? Water under the bridge. Just keep taking your money and let Roby be. So what did you want to talk about? What's the problem with this Darren Street?"
"He says he's going to run against me in the election. I don't know if he's bluffing. He hasn't picked up any qualifying papers, but he told 4 TBI agents who went to question him about a suspected kidnapping and murder that he was going to run against me."
Corker chuckled. "Be damned," he said. "If he does it, he's got some set of balls on him."
"It isn't funny," Morris said. "Street is smart and he's determined and he's been a darling in the press because of all the bad shit that's happened to him. He'll get thousands of votes on sympathy alone."
"Hasn't anybody made any progress on any of those murders he supposedly committed last year?"
"None. Nobody's even looking into them anymore. From what I've been able to find out, the files are closed. They're cold cases."
"And the latest? You said he told 4 TBI agents who went to question him about a possible kidnapping and murder that he was going to run against you. Is this kidnapping and murder a new case?"
"Yeah. The doctor who was supposed to be taking care of Street's girlfriend and the baby when they died has gone missing."
"What do you mean, supposed to be taking care of them?"
"He was on call, but he was drunk at a bar trying to pick up a woman. Street's girlfriend had a rare medical condition. If the doctor had been there and been sober, he could have handled it, and she and the baby would have been fine. But he didn't show up until it was too late, and even when he did show up, he was drunk."
"Sounds like a case you should use to make yourself look like a white knight," Corker said. "Prosecute the doctor. What could you make? Reckless homicide? Criminally negligent homicide?"
"Can't do it," Morris said.
"Why the hell not?"
"Two reasons. First off, the doctor is a friend. We go way back. Besides, it's a civil matter, not a criminal case. All Street has to do is sue him. I told him as much."
"He came to see you about it?"
"Yeah, he came to the office. I turned him down. He pretty much threatened me. But that's not the worst of it. The doctor has pulled a Ben Clancy. He's disappeared into thin air, vanished. No sign of him anywhere."
"Street?" Corker said.
"It's his modus operandi."
"Sounds like you've got a problem, counselor. So what do you want from me? What are you doing here?"
"I wanted to give you a heads up on Street, first of all. If he runs, he needs to be stopped. We've got too much at stake if he somehow manages to win."
"That ain't the way I see it," Corker said.
Morris's mouth dropped open. "What do you mean?"
"Nothing really changes for me if you lose," Corker said. "The worst thing I see happening is that there's one less finger in the pie."
"And what if I decide to go to the feds and tell them about your operation?"
"Then I'm afraid you and your wife and your children and your mama and daddy can expect a visit from Roby and some of his friends."
"Not even Roby would murder a district attorney general."
"I wouldn't count on that. If Roby gets wind that you're thinking of going to the feds, God knows what he'd do. Roby hates the federal government. His favorite nighttime reading is the Turner Diaries. Do you know the Turner Diaries?"
"Vaguely. Some fictional account of a radical who thinks the government wants to take his guns and his religion, so he decides to blow up some federal buildings."
"That book has inspired a lot of radical white folks, Mr. D.A.,
and Roby is one of them. I wouldn't mess with him if I were you, and I damned sure wouldn't go threatening to rat anybody out to the feds if you lose the election.
So this is how it's going to go, then?
Morris said. You're going to leave me hanging out on my own, fighting my own fight?
If I'm getting what you're saying, you're asking me to talk to my political base, maybe raise you some money, get some organizing done, that kind of thing. Maybe even come out publicly and endorse you. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's what you're hearing.
I don't recall you helping me get elected, Corker said. I don't recall you saying a word to help me or getting me a single vote. So I expect I'll just sit back and see which way the wind is blowing in a month or so. I'll probably have a sit-down with this Darren Street fellow, though, see what's on his mind, see if he's willing to join the congregation if you have to leave. And then I'll decide what to do. Whatever my decision, you can bet it'll be in my best interests.
Thanks a lot, Sheriff, Morris said. It's good to know loyalty doesn't mean shit to you.
A man who talks about loyalty in this line of work is a fool, Corker said. I believe in the good Lord above, but I also believe in evolution. Only the strong survive around here. Now I'm going to go back inside and watch this fight. I don't think it'd be a good idea for you to do the same.
Chapter 13. Corker watched while Morris stomped away, his shoulders slumped, muttering to himself.
Some folks just don't have what it takes to last at this kind of thing, Corker said aloud as he turned and started climbing the back steps to Roby's observation room.
Up to that point, Corker knew of nobody who had announced they were running against Morris in the November election. It was a powerful job, but it was thankless. There were almost 100 employees who brought all their personal baggage to work every day, and it paid less than 150 grand a year without the illegal perks. If a murder was committed and went unsolved, the DA got the blame. If it was solved and the guilty party went to prison for life, barely anyone noticed. Morris was unopposed in the August primary, which pretty much made him a slam dunk in November. But now this Darren Street apparently wanted in. Corker thought it might be difficult, though. Street had missed the primary election, so he would have to run as a write-in candidate. Write-in candidates were rarely elected, although it had happened on occasion. As he climbed the last step, Corker decided to just watch it play out. It might even be interesting.
You get rid of him,
Roby Penn growled as the sheriff stepped up to the window. The large crowd had circled two men below. Both were bare-chested and heavily tattooed, wearing only blue jeans and athletic shoes.
You know, it probably isn't a good idea to stick a Colt 45 in the face of the district attorney general, Corker said.
He's a pussy, Penn said. I don't trust him.
You don't trust anybody. I assume the Marine is the one with the buzz cut, Corker said.
That's him.
How much you got riding on him?
A couple grand.
Who you betting with? Yourself?
I'm betting with Harley Shaker. Harley's got some money. Ain't afraid to bet on himself.
Any man that wouldn't bet on himself has got no business down there, the sheriff said.
How about you? Penn said. Care to make a wager?
I'm not much of a gambling man, Roby, you know that. I just like to pick up my cash at the end of the day.
Sheriff Corker knew the rules of bare-knuckle boxing were simple. No biting, no gouging, no headbutting, no kicking, and no hitting a man when he was down. There were no time limits to the rounds. Once the referee said fight, they fought until one man either quit or was knocked unconscious. The sheriff had heard people say that bare-knuckle boxing was actually safer, in terms of head injury, than gloved boxing, because if the fighters hit each other in the head with as much force as they did with gloves, they'd break their hands. The two men downstairs were fairly evenly matched from a physical standpoint. Harley Shaker was a couple of inches taller than the Marine, but the Marine was thicker through the chest and shoulders. Harley's hair was long, black, and pulled into a ponytail. The Marine's hair was sandy blonde and less than a quarter inch long. The vocal crescendo built as the betting intensified and money changed hands.
The two men met with the referee in the center of the dirt floor, and he gave them last-second instructions. They touched fists, backed a few feet away from each other, and the referee said, "Fight." Shaker began circling to his left, and both men began throwing short, exploratory jabs. More punches were aimed at the bodies than at the heads. Shaker landed a solid right hook to the Marine's ribs, and the crowd became even more excited. The Marine backed away, gathered himself, and went back at Shaker with his fists close to his face. His left fist struck like a cobra and caught Shaker square in the temple. Shaker's knees buckled, and he nearly went down. As he gathered his balance, the Marine swarmed him, striking him 5 times in succession. One of the blows was solid to the solar plexus and took Shaker's breath. He fell to the floor in a heap. The Marine backed off as the men whooped.
"He's finished," Roby Penn said to the sheriff.
"I've seen Shaker take worse. Give him a minute."
The Marine stood over Shaker and spit on him.
"Fucking cracker," he said. "Pussy boy cracker."
It turned out to be a mistake. Shaker was on the ground for only a short time before he stood, staggered briefly before righting himself, shook his head, and let out a guttural yell.
"Looks like the Marine shouldn't have spit on Harley," the sheriff said. "I don't think he's taking it well."
"Bring it, soldier boy," Shaker yelled.
The Marine waged back in on light feet, taking short steps, maintaining his balance. He tried to sneak an uppercut in, but Harley blocked it with an elbow and countered with a hard right that caught the Marine flush across the bridge of the nose. Blood started pouring from the Marine's nostrils, and he fell backward. Now it was Harley's turn to pounce. He began pummeling the Marine with body shots and knocked him senseless with a precision blow to the chin. The Marine went straight over on his back as half the crowd roared and the other half booed. Shaker stood over the Marine for a second, but then he suddenly jumped on him, straddled him, and began beating him with his fists, elbows, and forearms. The referee pulled him off, but Shaker knocked the referee out cold with a punch to the temple. He turned back to the motionless Marine. Harley looked around, saw a piece of concrete the size of a brick on the ground a couple of feet away, picked it up, and bashed the Marine's skull several times with the concrete. He finally stood, dropped the concrete, and raised his arms in victory.
"Spit on me, would you?" Shaker yelled. "Fuck you! I done killed me a soldier boy!"
The crowd immediately began to disperse.
"Shit," Sheriff Corker said. "This ain't good."
"Get on down there," Roby said. "See if he's really dead."
"If he's really dead, I ain't here."
"Do you think I'm here? Do you think anybody was here, dead or alive? We gotta deal with him. All I'm asking you to do is go down there and check it out while I deal with my boys and the money. I'll be along directly."
Sheriff Corker descended the 2 flights of steps to the fighting area. Harley Shaker was standing 10 feet from the Marine, a wild look in his eyes. Everyone else, including the referee, had left.
"What the hell, Harley?" Corker said. "You know the rules."
"He spit on me. You seen it? He spit on me. Nobody spits on Harley Shaker and lives to tell about it."
The sheriff knelt and felt for a carotid pulse. Nothing. The Marine's eyes were bloody, open, and lifeless.
"You killed him," Corker said, struggling to stand back up.
"Shouldn't have spit on me."
"Do you know what kind of heat this could bring down on us?"
"I don't care. Bring the heat. He shouldn't have spit on me." "You gonna try to arrest me? 'Cause that won't go too good for you."
"No. Get on out of here."
"Not without my money. I want my money."
"Fine, you want your money. You can just hang around and collect from Roby. I don't know if he'll feel much like paying you, though, after what you've done."
A few minutes passed. Shaker paced in a circle, and the sheriff smoked a cigarette.
"Is he really dead?"
a rough voice said. It was Roby Penn. He walked through a back door and sauntered into the abandoned warehouse space a few minutes later.
"Deader than 4 in the morning,
Sheriff Corker said. Corker looked back down at the Marine, who had somehow chosen to come to this place for a bare-knuckle boxing match and wound up dead.
"Harley, you crazy son of a bitch. What'd you have to go and kill him for?"
"He spit on me, Roby. You seen it."
"And now we got a body on our hands that we have to get rid of. And this ain't just some redneck who lives with his granny, Harley. This boy's family has a bunch of money. They're gonna make sure people come looking for him.
So, we make sure they don't find him, Shaker said.
What do you think we ought to do with him, Tree? Penn said to the sheriff.
Shit, I don't know. We only got about 300 people running around out there who know what happened here today.
Yeah, and every one of them knows the code and the price for breaking it. They'll keep their mouths shut, Penn said.
Bull. They drink and they flap their gums, the sheriff said. Word'll get around.
So what do you want to do with him?
Get a truck, a tarp, and some shovels.
So you're gonna bury him? Penn said.
Where?
I figured it's your place and your problem, the sheriff said. Besides, you make the most money. You take on the worst problems when something goes bad.
You want me to bury him? You don't give me orders, fat man.
I'm not touching this, Roby. Make Harley help you. Maybe he'll think twice before he goes off on somebody again. And make sure y'all do it right. This guy needs to go away.
Chapter 14. A gleaming black Cadillac cruised slowly into the parking lot of a popular restaurant not far from Neyland Stadium and backed into a spot about 20 feet from where I was sitting. It was a new car, a sleek CT6 sedan. It looked like it should be carrying a mob boss. The windows were tinted, so I couldn't see who was driving. After receiving a phone call from Granny Tipton, I jogged from my apartment to a public park a couple of miles away, cutting through strip malls, doubling back, heading into and out of residential areas briefly, and then down Neyland Drive toward the restaurant. I had to make sure the cops weren't following me. After Dr. Nicholas Fratura, I'd gone back into full paranoid mode. It was an exhausting way to live, but I was already becoming used to it. I got up off the bench I was sitting on and walked toward the car. I went to the passenger side, opened the door, and peered in. The driver was a woman. She appeared to be about 40, a redhead with a creamy skin tone and barely noticeable freckles. Her eyes were clear and emerald green. Her hair was short and combed back from her forehead, held in place by mousse. Her jawline was taut and her cheekbones high. She had deep dimples in her cheeks. She smelled like a lilac bush and was nearly as pretty. She was wearing a black and white striped silk blouse open at the neck and a tight black skirt that went to mid-thigh. Coming out of the skirt were legs that were long and slim and covered in dark hose.
"Nice car," I said as I climbed in and sat down in a plush leather seat.
"You're sweating on it," she said.
"Sorry, I'll wipe it off when I leave." I stuck my hand out and she took it. "Darren Street," I said.
"Claire Tate."
"It's nice to meet you."
"My father's good friend Elizabeth Tipton says you need some political advice and organization."
"I'm blissfully ignorant of the process of getting oneself elected to public office," I said. "Never dreamed I'd be doing this."
Claire pulled out and began to drive.
"Well, I'm not blissfully ignorant," she said. "In fact, you might call me somewhat of an expert."
"Is that right? How many elections have you been involved in?"
"Close to 50, I'd say. I've been sort of a hired gun at times."
I was surprised by the number of elections in which she'd been involved, given her age.
"What's your winning percentage?" I said.
She turned and looked at me with those emerald eyes. Damn, she was pretty.
"Ms. Tipton told me you have a strong personality. She didn't tell me you're a smart ass."
"Legitimate inquiry," I said. "Do you at least win more often than you lose?"
"I rarely lose elections that I become involved in," she said. "When I do, it's usually because of my candidate. Candidates do stupid things and think nobody will find out. But when you run for a public office, you open yourself up to the microscope. Have you done anything stupid in your past, Mr. Street?"
I nodded vigorously. "I've done an incredible amount of stupid things in my past," I said. "I may be hopeless." She gave me a look of disdain and fixed her eyes back on the road.
"At least you're running in a county that doesn't care much about local elections," she said. "Knox County is indifferent for the most part. There are more than 330,000 adults of voting age, but only 225,000 of them have bothered to register to vote. On average, in a county election that involves the district attorney general, about 60,000 of those will actually cast a vote. So about 25%, one out of four registered voters, cares enough about the office to participate in the election.
That's almost depressing, I said. Claire Tate spoke with a southern accent, but it was refined, a bit like the high society Atlanta or Charleston accents I'd heard on occasion during my life. I wasn't really sure whether I liked it. It was pleasant enough, but it made her sound like a snob.
It shouldn't be depressing to you, Mr. Strait, she said, because it means you only have to get about 30,000 votes to win. And since you missed the qualifying deadline and will be running a write-in campaign, the fewer votes you have to get, the better. I realize that 30,000 may sound like a lot, but like I said, we have 225,000 voters out there. It's doable.
She reached out and pressed her finger against the display on the dashboard. The glove compartment opened in front of me.
There's a manila envelope in there, she said. It's for you. It's a packet of materials you need to have filled out and in my hands in 2 days.
What kind of materials? I said.
A qualifying petition, a petition to allow you to become a write-in candidate, some personal information needed by the Election Commission to make sure you qualify as a candidate. My understanding is there might be some things that would disqualify you, but we're going to keep those to ourselves.
What kind of things are you talking about? What would disqualify me?
Let's just say that I wouldn't suggest you write down anything about harming anyone.
She was obviously talking about the murders, and I'd never laid eyes on this woman before. She said Granny sent her, but maybe a cop had intercepted a call or gotten lucky somehow. For all I knew, there could be a recorder running in the car or a hidden microphone transmitting what we were saying to cops in a surveillance van.
Wait, I said. Stop the car. I want out.
Don't be silly, she said.
She was turning on a James B. White Parkway, and she stepped on the gas.
I'm your friend, she said. I shouldn't have said that. I apologize. Sometimes I just can't help myself.
She sounded sincere, but I wasn't going to give her anything at all.
I don't have any idea what you're talking about when you mention harming people, I said.
Of course you don't, she said. Good for you.
I sat up in the seat and turned toward her. I raised my voice a little, made my tone edgier.
Who the hell are you? I said. Really? Who is your father, and what is his connection to Elizabeth Tipton? Give me some facts I can check.
You don't have to curse at me, Mr. Strait, Claire said. Nor do you have to take that tone with me. I told you. My name is Claire Tate. I'm a strong and intelligent woman who was fortunate enough to be born the granddaughter of Senator Roger Tate.
The Senator Roger Tate? As in United States Senate?
That would be him.
I shook my head in wonder. Roger Tate was the senior U.S. Senator from Tennessee. He was the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, one of the most powerful committees in the Senate.
How does Granny know Roger Tate?
My grandfather grew up in the hills of Sevier County, not far from where Elizabeth Tipton grew up. They attended the same church. His family was poor, but he was ambitious, and he wound up getting out and doing some incredible things. He told me he was once very much in love with Miss Tipton before she became Miss Tipton, but that she didn't want to leave her beloved mountains. She wound up marrying another man and staying in the mountains while my grandfather went in another direction. But he remains fond of Miss Tipton, and is more than willing to help her any way he can, any time he can. He's also willing to turn a blind eye to some of the things she's done to provide for herself and her family. She reached out to him on your behalf, and here I am, my grandfather's emissary and your brand new campaign manager. I earned a bachelor's in political science from the University of Tennessee, a master's from the University of Virginia, and a law degree from Yale. And I'm a veteran of many political wars. If you want to become the next district attorney general of Knox County, you will do what I tell you when I tell you. Are we on the same page, Mr. Strait?
Call me Darren, I said. I hate being called Mr. Strait.
Maybe later, she said. Right now, I'd like to keep things on a professional level. You're Mr. Strait, and I'm Miss Tate.
Okay, I said. I'd calmed down and decided to mess with her head a little, just for some amusement. Are you single? I said.
Why would you ask that? Didn't I just say I want to keep this professional?
Just curious, I said. No offense intended. She glanced over at me and sighed.
Single, never been married.
Lipstick lesbian.
Why is it that anyone over 25 who isn't married must be a lesbian?
I'm guessing you're mid to late 30s and you're extremely attractive. It was just a question. You don't have to answer.
Why would you even care?
I don't. I'm just testing your limits. You'll find that I enjoy doing that on occasion.
I'm not a lesbian. I just don't like men much. I find them boorish and boring. And you just proved my point.
Thanks, I said.
You're welcome. Now, if you're finished with your inquiries into my sexual preferences, maybe we can get on with some productive discussion?
By all means, productively discuss, I said.
You need to hold a press conference in the near future.
Okay, I said. How do I go about getting the press to come?
Leave that to me. You will undoubtedly face some questions about certain crimes some people believe you have committed. I'll coach you how to handle those questions.
You don't have to coach me, I said. I may be boorish and boring, but I'm not stupid. I haven't committed any crimes. I'll just deny it.
Some methods of denial are more effective than others, Mr. Street, she said.
Seems pretty simple to me. I didn't do it. I've never committed a crime in my life, and anyone who says I have is a liar.
Misinformed or mistaken are better. Liar is too combative.
Fine.
Are you always this prickly? She said. You'll need to be nice to people if you want them to vote for you.
I can be nice when I want to, I said. I was enjoying the back and forth. She was bright and quick, and she smelled so damn good. But I didn't know her from Adam. I'd been burned in the past, so I wasn't going to trust her blindly.
Good. Try to want to right now.
I get upset when people accuse me of committing crimes I haven't committed. What made you mention it anyway?
I believe Ms. Tipton may have said something to my grandfather about you having some skeletons in your closet.
Granny would never say anything like that about me, I said.
My grandfather doesn't like surprises, she said. I'm sure Ms. Tipton knows that. He would want to know everything he could about you before he agreed to something as unusual as what we're about to do. He's going to personally endorse you, you know. That in itself will go a long way toward beating Morris. He's also going to request that some money be discreetly transferred from his treasury to yours.
Damn, I said. Granny must have something on him that's pretty embarrassing.
I'm sure she doesn't have anything on him, Claire said. There's still such a thing as loyalty, you know. My grandfather is extremely loyal to his old friends.
Whatever, I said. But like I said, I don't have any idea what you're talking about as far as skeletons in my closet. I think I'm ready to go back now. Will you take me back to the park?
You're as ungrateful as you are insolent, she said.
Not ungrateful, and I don't mean to be insolent. I'm just extremely careful. She turned the car off I-40 and headed back in the direction of the park where she'd picked me up. We rode in silence for a while before she spoke again. Her tone was gentler, almost kind.
I know you've been through some incredibly difficult things, she said. I'm genuinely sorry for your losses, all of them, and so is my grandfather. You've seen more than your share of pain.
I didn't quite know what to say, so I said nothing for several seconds. Why are you really helping me? I said as she pulled into the parking lot at the park.
Because my grandfather asked me to help you, she said. Because Ms. Tipton asked my grandfather to help you. And because I think it'll be fun. I can't wait to see the look on that weasel Stephen Morris's face when he finds out Roger Tate is backing you and Claire Tate is your campaign manager.
You know Morris? I said.
Went to the University of Tennessee at the same time he did. We had a political science class together. One day he got it into his head that it would somehow be a good idea to kiss my neck and pinch me on the posterior.
Really? And how did that go over?
He lost a tooth.
She handed me a card and a prepaid phone as I opened the door to get out.
My number's on the back. Always call me from that phone. I have a prepaid, too. The number is already programmed into yours. I'll return calls and call you from my prepaid. We'll get new ones every couple of weeks. And get those papers back to me within 2 days.
Will do, I said, and I climbed out of the car. To my surprise, she climbed out on the other side and walked around the car. It was the first time I'd seen her standing up, and it was an image I knew I wouldn't ever forget.
Mr. Street, just one more thing before you go. I think we should get this out of the way right now. I don't care what you've done in the past. I've heard the circumstances and the allegations, and if they're true, I want you to know I don't judge you. I probably would have done the same things you did. There's a part of me that admires you, not only for what you did, but also for getting away with it.
I didn't do anything, I said. I wondered whether what she just said was genuine. If so, I thought I'd come to like her very much. If not, well, I'd deal with that when the time came. Still, she seemed genuine, and I'd developed a strong bullshit detector over the years.
I know, she said. I just thought you needed to hear that.
I stood there watching as the Cadillac drove away. This woman is different from Grace, I thought to myself. I didn't know whether that was good or bad. Chapter 15. I called Granny Tipton the morning after I took a ride with Claire Tate. She told me vaguely what it was she knew about Senator Roger Tate that would allow her to get him on the phone and agree to help me win the District Attorney General's election in Knoxville. I was right about it being something embarrassing. She told me Senator Tate had possessed an affinity for drinking moonshine whiskey and having sex with multiple women at the same time when he was building his wealth and political machine. With a young wife and baby at home, he'd needed a discreet place to indulge those affinities. Granny's husband just happened to have opened a tavern outside Sevierville that the young senator, he was a state senator then, would drive all the way from Nashville to visit from time to time. It afforded him an opportunity to visit his parents and family and, while doing so, scratch an itch. She mentioned there might have been photographs involved. Still, she said their friendship was strong.
"Roger has a genuine affection for me," she told me over the phone, "and he will have until he knows the photographs can no longer be used against him, which means he will have a genuine affection for me until the day he dies, because I've told him that if I die, I'll simply pass them along to my grandchildren with very specific instructions on how to use them. They're in remarkably good condition. We've been extremely careful with them over all these years."
"Have you ever asked him for anything else?" I said.
"I use the leverage very sparingly," she said.
"Thank you for using it now," I said.
"It isn't all for you, Darren. It isn't an act of generosity. We stand to make a great deal of money in Knox County once Roby Penn is gone and we can move in."
"Is Penn really that bad?"
"A very unpleasant fellow. I'm sure you'll meet him at some point. In the meantime, Senator Tate wants to meet with you. I haven't told you this, but he does have some conditions for helping you. I think they're reasonable, but they could put you in some danger."
"Danger? What does he want?"
"I think you should discuss it with him."
"When does he want to meet?"
"He said he can fly in day after tomorrow. We'll talk here at my house."
"Sounds like a plan." The senator was 71 years old, Granny told me, and had grown up about 2 miles from her house where his family scratched a living out of the mountain on a farm, raising cattle and tobacco. She knew him from both church and the one-room school in which they were educated. He excelled at academics, was charming and personable, and she knew early on that he was destined for things far beyond the Smoky Mountains. They were also attracted to each other, she said.
"It was physical," she told me. "The kind of thing that happens when people are young and hormones are raging."
They'd sneaked off on occasion and spent time together. I would never have been so impolite as to ask Granny whether they ever had sex, and she didn't volunteer any information on that front. They'd drunk moonshine together, which Granny's father had made, and fooled around some. That was as far as she would go. Granny's father had taught her his recipe, and she believed herself to be one of a very small number of young women in or around Sevier County, Tennessee, who'd known how to make corn liquor. When the time came for Roger Tate to go off to the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, he'd proposed to her, but her parents had been in ill health and she hadn't wanted to leave them or her mountains. She'd turned him down, and he'd left.
"He wrote me letters over the years, and he stopped by to see me a couple of times," she said. He worked his way through college in only 3 years and then went to law school at Vanderbilt in the late 1960s, she said. When he graduated, he got a job as general counsel at a medical supply company that was being started by one of his friends. They didn't have much money, so he took most of his salary in stock options. They built the company steadily, and 5 years later it went public. Roger became an instant multimillionaire that day. He eventually bought controlling interest in the company and still owns it, I believe. He's one of the richest men in the United States Senate, if not the richest.
Where did his political career start? I asked. Did he represent Sevier County?
No, he was beyond us at that point. He had established a home in Nashville by then where his business was, so he ran for one of the Nashville district seats. Won big, too. He served 3 terms in the Tennessee Senate and then ran for the big time, the United States Senate. By that time, he had more money than any of his competitors. He basically bought the seat, which is how it's done routinely these days, from what I understand.
And he's been in the United States Senate for what, 40 years?
I suppose that'd be about right.
Wow, people think these little local offices are powerful, I said. Head of the Appropriations Committee? Control over the purse strings? That's real power.
It hasn't gone to his head, Granny said. I think you'll like him.
I'll see you in a couple of days, then, I said. What should I wear?
Just be yourself, she said. Roger doesn't much care for fancy.
Chapter 16. I spent about an hour filling out the forms for Claire Tate after I hung up the phone. They were routine questions that asked whether I'd ever been convicted of a felony, whether I owed a bunch of money to the government, how old I was, how long I'd been a resident of the state and the city slash county, and whether I was a licensed attorney. When I was finished, I went for a run. I found that the running did me a lot of good. It helped me clear my head, and it made me feel better. I talked to Grace a lot during the runs, not out loud but in my head, and I would try to imagine her answering. I hoped she approved of the direction I was headed, and I hoped she thought I'd make a fine district attorney. But Grace hadn't appeared since she'd stepped through the veil. I had the feeling she'd abandoned me, that she'd moved on to another plane and had put me behind her. I tried talking to my mother, too. I also imagined that she seemed pleased about me going after the district attorney's job, but like Grace, my mother had faded far off into the distance. I ran for an hour and got back to the apartment, intending to take a shower and then go get some lunch. Something felt wrong as soon as I entered my apartment. I couldn't quite grasp what it was, but I felt it the second I walked through the door. I stepped through the foyer, and there, sitting at my kitchen counter, was a large man in a uniform wearing a cowboy hat. I recognized him from television and from the few times I'd seen him in court. Sheriff Clifford Tree Corker. I stopped and stared at him. "I believe it's a crime to break into people's homes without their permission," I said.
"You gonna arrest me?"
"You pick the lock?"
"Never met one I couldn't."
I walked to the refrigerator and pulled out a bottle of water.
"You want one?"
I said.
"Nah, don't drink much water. You got a beer in there?"
I grabbed a beer. I walked over and set it down on the counter in front of him while I took a seat across from him.
"What can I do for you, Sheriff?"
"I hear you're considering a run for the district attorney's office," he said.
"You heard wrong."
"That right? How so?"
"I'm not considering it, I'm doing it. Come November, there'll be a new DA here in Knoxville."
"Damn, boy. They didn't tell me you were so cocky."
"What do you want?"
I said. "This is a nice little place you got here,"
the sheriff said as he popped the cap off the beer bottle and took a drink.
"Nice and cozy.
Either tell me what you want or get out of my apartment. I don't give a shit who you are or who you think you are. You don't break into my house without a damn good reason."
"And if I don't have a good reason?"
"Let's just say there could be consequences."
"Damn," Corker said. "You are a rooster, ain't you? What are you gonna do? Kill me like them other 5?
"No idea what you're talking about."
"Of course not. So what are you going to do?"
I'm going to give you about 10 seconds to tell me what you're doing here. After 10 seconds, I'm going to kick your fat ass all over this apartment. I'll give you 100-to-1 odds I can get across this counter before you can get one of those pistols out of the holster. If I'm wrong and you kill me, I'm sure you'll get away with it. But I won't care, will I? I'll be dead.
Are you telling me you're not afraid to die, boy?
Not in the least. And don't ever call me boy again. Now what's it going to be? I felt my body beginning to tense as I prepared to leap across the counter and commence pummeling the pink-faced bastard. I was looking him straight in the eye, and I saw him give in. I knew right then that at his core, this huge, pistol-toting redneck was a coward.
"Take it easy," he said, holding up both of his hands. "Stephen Morris came to see me and wanted me to talk to you. About what? Maybe reconsidering? He'd make it worth your while to stay out of the race."
"Really? How much?"
"I don't know exactly. I'm thinking somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 100 grand, I'd imagine."
"Damn," I said. "His salary isn't much more than 100 grand a year. Why would he want to pay me so much?"
"Let's just say it's possible he makes a little on the side."
"Yeah, I've heard," I said. "I've also heard it's more than a little. Let me see if I've got this right. You and your department turn your backs to cockfighting, dogfighting, bare-knuckle fighting, prostitution, gambling in several forms, and drug distribution. In exchange, you get a cut of the action. The district attorney gets a cut, too, because he isn't up your ass all the time about bringing cases for him to prosecute. You let a select few people operate with impunity, and whenever somebody new and stupid comes along and tries to set up shop, your select few operators, who also double as informants, help you set them up and bust them. You run them through the system, send them off to jail, and look like a real sheriff instead of the corrupt asshole you really are. How am I doing?"
"Nearly good enough to get yourself killed," the sheriff said.
"Relax," I said. "You don't have to worry about me. I don't have any intention of getting in the middle of your business. I'll have some minor demands, but I don't think you'll have a problem with them. If I win, you can keep going business as usual, with a couple of small changes."
"What kind of changes?"
"Like I said, minor changes. There may be someone I want you to let in, which means someone will have to go. Is that going to be a problem?"
"Probably not. Depends on who's coming in and what they want to do."
"It'll be someone experienced, somebody who knows what they're doing. They'll agree to the terms that are already in place, whatever they are."
"Who's gonna have to go?" Corker said.
"I think I'll keep that to myself for now," I said. "But we can work something out. We're reasonable men, right? We can find mutually beneficial solutions to problems. Can't we?"
"Don't know if I can trust you yet," Corker said. "If you ain't with us, you're against us."
"The truth is, I don't give a shit about you and what you do or don't do. The sheriff's real job is supposed to consist of 3 things, if I'm correct. One is to maintain the jail, and I know from first-hand experience that you do a lousy job of that. The second is courthouse security. Last is law enforcement, and for you guys, that's mostly domestic violence and meth heads. Your guys don't even write speeding tickets because it costs you votes when they do."
"We enforce the law," Corker said.
"No, you don't. You get in front of a television camera every chance you get to give the appearance you're enforcing the law. But that's okay with me. I don't care. Keep faking it. My office will crack down on homicides, armed robberies, gangs, home invasions, things like that, most of which happen in the city. I'll concentrate on making the city and the county, where I can, safer. Now, if you let things get out of hand and the drug trade gets violent or people start pulling out guns at the cockfights, things will change. You and I will have a problem. But as long as you and your operators keep a low profile, see no evil, hear no evil." The sheriff rocked back and forth in the stool he was sitting on for a few seconds, sizing me up.
"I don't like Morris," he said. "He's like a damned whiny child, and he lives like a king. He might as well put a sign out front of his house that says, 'Screw you, FBI. I'm on the take, and there's nothing you can do about it.' You, I maybe could get to like, but I'm not sure. You've got that look in your eye, that I don't give a damn look."
I don't, I said. A man who doesn't give a damn is dangerous.
Maybe Morris will beat me and you won't have to worry about anything.
Corker shook his head slowly. Somehow I just don't see that happening. I've seen you do some pretty incredible things in the past.